Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode. Part of the Apologetic series, posted October 31st, 2023, titled No, Jesus Wasn't Special, featuring Dr. James Tabor, Jeremiah Johnson responses.
That's called Body of Proof, a very, very new book, just came out by Jeremiah J. Johnson.
I'm hoping people are going to watch this program and they might engage with the final two chapters of my book.
Well, you've got your wish. And I'm bringing a world-renowned scholar with me.
Can say, hey, I'm going to go do a PhD on one of those two subjects because I think I could build a research question on one of those two interesting arguments.
It's a pity you didn't do sufficient research before you published your book, but we're here to help. Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians. And today,
I'm talking today with Dr. Jeremiah Johnston, who recently wrote a book entitled Body of Proof, but the subtitle here, The 7 Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today.
We've covered Dr. Johnston on the channel before, but this new interview kicks off with a rather bold apologetic claim, and it involved the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I thought I'd bring back on one of the world's leading scholars on the topic, Dr. James Tabor.
It's good to be with you, Paul. Always glad to explore these mysteries of the Bible and apologetics. In ancient scrolls, Dead Sea Scrolls is my thing.
And I'm currently taking your new Dead Sea Scrolls course.
Yeah, it's actually got this audacious title, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, he wasn't even born when the Dead Sea Scrolls were written, so obviously what I'm doing is comparing two messianic movements. The one that I call the first Messiah, which would be the Messiah of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then it asks the question, if you fast forward 150 years to the time of Jesus, first century CE, rather than first century BCE, what are the differences and similarities?
We'll talk more about that later in the video. For now, let's see what Cameron and Jeremiah have to say on the best evidence for Jesus' resurrection. Have you heard of Dr. Johnston?
I can't say that I have for sure because there's another preacher also who I think is called Jeremiah Johnson that I have come across, and he's older than this gentleman. So, but his book sounds very interesting. The title, he seems pretty confident that it's showing some sort of uniqueness.
Just tell me the first one. What is a good reason to believe that Jesus actually rose physically from the dead?
The first one is this, and let me see how I say it in the book. And the Jesus's bodily resurrection was not what any of his disciples expected or anticipated because they didn't expect the Messiah to die.
One of the things that apologists often try to say, and Dr. Johnson also makes this point, that the career pattern of Jesus, that is teaching, suffering, death, and resurrection, is unique in all of Second Temple Judaism, from the Maccabees all the way down to Bar Kokhba. Nobody ever heard of this, so nobody was expecting it. And therefore, when it happened, it makes Jesus unique. And that actually is incorrect, as we will explore, because the very first Messiah that we have record of, not the dozen or more later, that's the leader of the Dead Sea Scroll group, who's anointed of the Spirit. That's why I'm calling him the Messiah. And we'll get into that as we go along. But he also talks about suffering, resurrection, and ascending to heaven. How about that?
Wow. All before Jesus.
It doesn't mean Jesus didn't do it or did do it, but you don't make this point that because Jesus is the only one about whom such claims are made, he's got to be the one.
Right.
I studied Hellenistic religions. You know what's most common with these, you could call them messianic figures or holy men or divine men in the Hellenistic world, and we got dozens of them. They get persecuted, often killed by authorities, and then they ascend to heaven in a resurrection.
Sounds
That's
familiar.
The pattern. That is the pattern. It's not the exception.
This is made very clear in 4Q285, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
It's called 4Q285, and he kind of rattles that off, which is fine. But what it means is cave 4, there were 11 caves with scrolls found at Qumran. Q is Qumran, that's the site of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And 285 is the number, the catalog number of this tiny little fragment of five lines about the size of a matchbook, like a paper matchbook.
Wow.
And so we don't have a lot to go on, but he is confident that this talks about the Messiah killing his enemies, when it's very possible that it talks about the enemies killing the Messiah.
Oh,
it's controversial.
Wow.
And we're going to talk about it. So,
all right.
But well, I published that text and actually have worked on it quite a bit. And I'll be fair with him, because actually either reading is possible. And so it has to be decided by context. And I'll explain that when we look more closely at the text.
Where the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is the Essene community, of course, of late antiquity, this would be the Dead Sea Scroll Qumran community, they make the point, Cameron, that they expected, their messianic hopes were that the Messiah, should he appear, would kill the Kittim. That was code for the Roman Empire, and specifically the Roman occupiers and the Roman emperor himself. So they were expecting a conquering king. Certainly no one was expecting a Messiah to die. And so here's that leads right into my point. And this is an original contribution of this book. I preceded it by publishing it in a textbook on the philosophy of religion in a chapter 16 called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. I give the academic side there. This is more of a popular treatment, but there's no motivation psychologically. Here's the point. No motivation psychologically for the early Jewish followers of Jesus to invent a resurrection narrative. Judaism is a coherent religion. Early Jews, and for that matter, all Jews, believed in a future eschatological resurrection.
There are a lot of points that Dr. Johnson just made, but let me start with the text he mentions in the Dead Sea Scrolls, 4Q285. This is a five-line text. It's about the size of a paper matchbook, and I'll read it to you, and it has to do with how you translate it. And I'm sure he covers this in his book.
Sorry to interrupt. Future Apologia here. After my conversation with Dr. Tabor, I bought and read Dr. Johnson's book to make sure we weren't inadvertently misrepresenting his work. Not only does the book not cover translation nuances of 4Q285, he doesn't mention 4Q285 or any Dead Sea passage. In the relevant passage discussing the pre-existing resurrection beliefs of Jewish groups, he speculates about the Dead Sea Scroll group beliefs possibly liking the book of Daniel, rather than presenting or quoting a single passage from the actual Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. I don't know why he made it the centerpiece of this particular interview when it's not in the book. Anyhow, very disappointing all around. Hail Skynet.
It's controversial. You finally have to go by context, but it actually depends upon one letter and how you put a point or a vowel point in that letter. And since the Dead Sea Scrolls don't put vowel points, you have to go by context. So you can make a good argument for the case he's giving. In fact, I think most scholars would agree with it. It was first argued by Geza Vermes, V-E-R-M-E-S, a great Dead Sea Scroll scholar who's now passed away, a friend of mine, a personal friend of mine. I've even been with him to Qumran, been to Dead Sea Scroll conferences with him. So here's what the text says, five lines. It says, Isaiah the prophet, so we know where we are. The scepter shall go forth from the root of Jesse. That's a clear actual quotation from Isaiah 11. It's the great messianic text of the Hebrew Bible. And the branch of David normally would refer to the Davidic Messiah. So it is about the Messiah. Then it says in the plural, they will judge. They will judge. And then they will put to death the leader of the community, the branch of David. With piercings and stripes, a priest will command it. Now, that's the translation of Michael Wise. Vermes would suggest that it's not a pierced Messiah, it's a piercing Messiah. this Messiah is going to pierce the Romans. That's what Johnson's arguing. Most scholars would agree with that. However, the argument depends on a single letter. The verb put to death, if it's hemetu, then it's they will do it to the Messiah. They'll kill him. And if it's hemeto, one vowel sound different, and there are no vowels in the text, then it would be that he will actually kill them. So it's not that Jeremiah's wrong there necessarily. He's holding a view that many scholars hold. But when Vermeersch published this in Bar Magazine in 1992, and I give you all this in my course, by the way, I'm not just trying to push the course, but you get all of these articles and texts where you can read back and forth. I wrote a response to him, and he was very courteous, as he always was. And he said, well, it finally depends on context. But here's some other things I pointed out. If the verb is plural on judging, they will judge, which it definitely seems to be, then why not they will kill? And the piercing and wounding is really interesting because that's not in Isaiah 11. Mm. Where is it? Zechariah 12, verse 10, Christians know this very well. And they will look on the one they have pierced and mourn for him as an only son. Well, this Dead Sea Scroll group is very familiar with that text. In fact, in that text, it says, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. Jesus applied that to himself the night of his betrayal on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay? He says, hey guys, you know, in the Gospel of Mark at least, it is written, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. That's the same section of Zechariah about piercing. So my argument was, wait a minute, before we say this is the conquering Messiah, there's no doubt it's finally the conquering Messiah because he comes back like in the New Testament in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who know not the Lord Jesus and so forth. That's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, book of Revelation, the guy on the white horse in chapter 19. So yeah, he comes back conquering, but does he suffer and die before he's conquered? Now, I think Dr. Johnson would say, well, yeah, with Jesus, but nobody else.
Mm.
But in the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is also quoted. For example, Psalm 22 in the Dead Sea Scrolls reads, they've pierced my hands and feet, using the piercing again. And it's applied to the teacher, basically.
Oh.
Whereas in the Masoretic text, you basically have, like a lion, they've surrounded me. So this pierced my hands and feet, that was actually in the Dead Sea Scroll Bible. Okay. So what they're assembling texts together, just like Christians did. Oh, they'll look on the one that's pierced, strike the shepherd, they pierced my hands and feet. But they're applying these not to Jesus, obviously, because they come 150 years before Jesus.
Of course.
But to their teacher. Now, there are three messiahs in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's the teacher, he's the prophet like Moses. And then there are the two messiahs, one of David and one of Aaron, the priest. So you got a priestly, a kingly, and the teacher. And so their teacher, we have his actual writings. We think in the Thanksgiving hymns, he talks in the first person, especially hymns 10 through 17. And what does he say? My enemies have lifted up their heel against me after dipping bread with me at the table. Does that sound like anybody you know?
He also
talks about his best friend betraying him and turning against him, someone of his own counsel. Now, again, it's not like Jesus is copying this. It's the history of these messianic groups. You often get a dissident that might betray the teacher, and that's what happens to him. But then he begins to say, no one is like me in my suffering. And he refers to Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, him, that all Christians apply to Jesus. He applies it to himself. And what does that say? Wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. That's in the Dead Sea Scrolls, applied to the teacher. And in fact, in the great commentary on the book of Habakkuk, the Dead Sea Scrolls tell you how you're going to be saved by faith. They actually quote, the just shall live by faith, same as Paul. But they say it means those who have faith in the teacher of righteousness and suffer with him so that they'll be glorified with him. Does that sound kind of familiar, like Romans 8? I'm telling you, that's what I do in the course. I try to, it's not to say that Jesus copied the scrolls or anything like that. What it's saying is, within Judaism, unlike Dr. Johnson's implying, there's this monolithic whole Messiah is always powerful and great, never defeated, that Jews are well aware in many texts of the suffering. For example, there's 4Q 4:9-1, where the teacher in the first person, this is part of the Thanksgiving hymns, we think, he says, I'm reckoned among the gods, a mighty throne is set for me in heaven, no one is exalted beside me, there's no one to compare with me. That's the glorified part. But then he also says, I'm rejected and wounded, and quotes the thing about strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. So when their teacher died, they turned to some of these same texts that Christians later turned to explain, how could he have died? He was the one to come. And what they found within these texts were another aspect of the Messiah or the teacher like Moses, and that is the suffering. And there are two books that were published around the year 2000, and I'm sure Dr. Johnson knows these books. One is Michael Wise, The First Messiah, Investigating the Messiah Before Jesus. Independently, Michael didn't know Israel Knoll, Hebrew University scholar. He published a book called The Messiah Before Jesus, and they didn't copy each other. And what did they both argue? That the figure in the scrolls that we know as the teacher, anointed of the Spirit, they believed he would be cut off, that he'd be wounded and pierced. He would be the shepherd struck, but God would exalt him to heaven. So you've actually got the entire pattern within the Dead Sea Scrolls. They also quote of Psalm 37, you've killed the righteous one, in one of the K4 documents. And they interpret that again as the righteous one would be the righteous teacher. So it's true that we've got a whole string of figures that are powerful and ruling, and they take up arms and try to defeat the Romans. But we've also got texts, particularly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where the suffering comes out and the community has to suffer with the teacher in order to be exalted. Kind of reminds me of the Gospel of Mark. If you would come after me, Jesus says, we're all going to go to the cross together. And if you humble yourselves, you'll be exalted. But if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. So the two guys in Mark that want to sit on the right and left hand of Jesus when he comes into his kingdom, it's the sons of Zebedee, right? The fishermen, James and John. Jesus rebukes them, says, you have no idea what you're asking. The suffering has to come first, right? So that's Mark. Dead Sea Scrolls are identical. They actually say that. I'm not saying they're identical to Jesus in every way, but on this point, suffering before glory and no glory without suffering. So if there is a Davidic Messiah that doesn't suffer, he's not going to qualify. They also quote in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's called the Melchizedek text from Cave 11. And guess what it says? That the anointed of the Spirit will come. He's called the anointed prince. And then it says he will be cut off and have nothing. They quote that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they're very well aware of this idea that the leader could be killed and pierced and wounded and yet be exalted and raised to heaven. And I think they believe that about their teacher. Now, did they think then that he wasn't returning as a conquering warrior? Of course not. They thought that he would be exalted. They still believe they were going to conquer the Kittim someday and he would be at their head. But before that, he gets rejected and suffers. And I think the pattern is clear. I don't think they're identical. I think there are many differences between the Jesus movement and the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were much more militant. They did believe in gathering arms, and they planned apparently for a real fight with the Romans, whereas Jesus planned on calling 12 legions of angels to rescue him if he was going to, you know, oppose the Romans. He was a pacifist from what we know. Some have argued that he's militant. I don't think that he was. So in that sense, the ideologies of the two groups are different, as Dr. Johnson says. But the idea that there's no suffering anointed one who is killed and then exalted to heaven is simply, I don't think it holds up. I want to add this. Years after Geza Vermish and I had this discussion in Bar Magazine, this friendly discussion, he thanks me, I thank him, we're not battling or anything, we're just discussing what a vowel point might be in a text full of lines. We're at Qumran, and we're with a whole group of scholars, and we sit down, we have a coffee together in the visitor center. And he said, you know, James, years ago when we had that little exchange, I still think what I argued's right, but I want you to know that your interpretation, given all the other texts that have come out, remains a possibility. And he said, I admire you for, I was a young scholar in 1990s. I mean, look how long ago that was.
No, and that was just 10 years ago.
Yeah. And for me to write an article kind of disagreeing with someone as towering as Geza Vermish, but you know what? He wanted people to come and question. All great professors are like that. I hope I'm like that if I'm a great professor. I want to know. I want Dr. Johnson. I'd love to sit and have a coffee with him and get the text out and show him another possibility. And he seems like a very nice guy. I'm sure he would probably enjoy that. So who knows in the future? I'm not so much wanting to debate as to point out that what he says is not an accurate statement about the scrolls. There's much more in the scrolls we need to consider. And I would encourage people to study the scrolls themselves too. I'm not just trying again to hawk my course here, but so many people hear about the scrolls or they see things like this, you know, 4Q 285, what is that? So many people hear a scroll quoted, but there's not much opportunity for people who aren't in university settings and taking university courses to study these things for themselves. And in the course that I offer on the scrolls, I consider all the viewpoints. One thing I want to add, though, Paul, that I really think is important. The underlying difference I have with Dr. Johnson on this point is not just what that text might mean or other texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's his assumption that the gospel accounts are our earliest accounts of resurrection of Jesus. That is Mark, who has no appearances, Matthew, who has them on a mountain with some doubting, Luke, who has everything in Jerusalem and nothing in the Galilee, and John, who has both, where they're having these sightings of Jesus. But the earliest account is Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, or 1 Corinthians 9, where he also says that he's seen the Lord. But when you ask him, well, what did you see? And he equates his seeing with theirs. He says, I was last, but I wasn't the least, because I've worked harder than them all. He tells you that whenever he talks about these other apostles. But in terms of testimony to resurrection, yes, it was bodily. It was bodily. But here's the question. What kind of a body was it according to Paul? And Paul makes it absolutely clear that it is what he calls a spiritual body, a wind body. And he says, I can't describe it because it's a heavenly phenomena. It sounds a lot like the book of Acts. A blinding light with a voice or something of that nature.
Depending on which part of Acts you read, I guess.
Yeah, I wrote my dissertation on Paul's ascent to paradise and from the third heaven and so forth. So I studied all of the ascent traditions of the Hellenistic world, every one of them, from ancient times all the way through the time of Jesus and Paul and even past that. And I tried to understand what it means for someone who's believed by the community to be exalted to heaven, to have a heavenly vision of that figure. And it is something that we know in the Hebrew Bible called astral immortality. It means you'll be like the stars shining forever. And that's what the earliest believers thought. They weren't interested in the body or the bones of a corpse. Paul even says the body you shuffle off like old clothing, rotten clothing, right? And the new clothing you put on is your spiritual body. So Jesus, according to Paul, was raised gloriously in a new body clothed in immortality. And I think that's the real question I would have about his argument on the authenticity of the resurrection is you need to look at the earliest account. I have an article on my blog, jamestabor.com, that I want to mention. It's easy to find. Why people are confused about the earliest views of resurrection of the dead. And you're going to find Michael Heiser, for example, the late Michael Heiser, said it was the best article on resurrection that he'd ever read, but he disagreed with it. And we had a very friendly exchange on his website. It's still up. People can Google it and find it. Because Michael realized that what I was arguing has some potential validity. And it's, you know, maybe Dr. Johnson would delve into that as well. I think it's something that people should be discussing in a sharp but friendly way, because I'm not just trying to debunk apologists and say they're all wrong. What I'm trying to do is to be accurate with the sources. And if somebody says, oh, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's only the triumphant Messiah, and ignores these very poignant references to woundings, piercing, killing the righteous one, and so forth, that are also throughout the scrolls, even applied to the teacher and to his two anointed ones. I think he, like Jesus, said to his followers, you want to sit on the right and left hand? Well, I'm going to go through suffering. And if you don't go through suffering with me, those won't be your positions. I don't have anything from him that exactly says that. But if you read the Thanksgiving hymns 10 through 17, you'll think you're reading the thoughts of somebody like Jesus. Betrayal, suffering, trials. And he refers to Isaiah 53 and applies it to himself, the suffering servant. So Jews knew about the suffering servant. People always say, well, that's the nation of Israel. Of course it's the nation of Israel, but it's not the nation of wicked Israel. It's the nation of God's righteous remnant of Israel that suffer because they do righteousness. That is a motif throughout Judaism. It's found in many texts of the Hebrew Bible as well as rabbinic literature and other Jewish materials.
So to put a bit of a bow on that, it is Dr. Johnson's hypothesis that the Dead Sea Scrolls show us that Jesus' followers were the very first to apply proof texts like Psalm 22, Jeremiah, and Zechariah to a messianic candidate who suffered and died. But you're demonstrating how the Dead Sea Scrolls really show us this was already an existing known motif at and before the time of Jesus, not at all unique to Christianity. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I think it's an important aspect of understanding Judaism. There's another text that is a kind of a Dead Sea Scroll text, but it wasn't found at the Dead Sea. It was found in Jordan. It's called the Gabriel Stone or Revelation. Israel Knoll published it. And it talks about a Messiah being slain and killed and left on the ground to rot. It's not Jesus. It's dated before the time of Jesus. We think it might be this character that Josephus mentions, Simon of Perea. We think it might be him because that's where it's found. And it says that he's going to get slain, and Simon was beheaded by the Romans. And then after 3 days, I will raise him up. So there you have, again, a text about a slain Messiah who's going to get raised up. Now, that text, like this 4Q285 text, has some difficult readings because there are no vowels. But Israel Knoll has made some pretty strong arguments that it's talking about, after 3 days, I will raise him up. And I've looked at it firsthand, the actual stone I've looked at and examined with the magnifying glass. And I'm persuaded that it does talk about a Messiah being killed and raised. And that's simply a kind of a tombstone or testimony to faith that he is still going to be the one, if it does refer to Simon. So these are not all monolithic. And I even wonder whether the Bar Kokhba reference that he gives about Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba, as he was called. Remember, Bar Kokhba means son of a star. We know his real name from texts that he wrote that have been found at the Dead Sea, actual letters where he signs his name. His name is Bar Kokhba, so it's a play on words. Well, son of a star comes from the book of Numbers, and it talks about a star rising. And we don't know for sure. He was finally killed, of course, by the Romans in that horrible second revolt where hundreds of thousands of Jews were slaughtered. But to somebody of faith, and we don't have, like, the followers of Bar Kokhba, did they give up? They could have well believed, well, wait a minute, he's the son of a star. And what does the prophecy of Balaam say in the book of Numbers 24? I see a star rising, right? And a scepter. They might have believed and hoped that he would somehow come back, depending on their fervency of their belief. So you got to be really careful with these monolithic takes on late Second Temple Judaism trying to make Jesus unique. To me, it's better for Jesus and for our understanding of the Christian movement to realize that he comes out of a context in which these materials are being discussed and applied at various points to various figures, because then he becomes part of a dialogue and a discussion and exchange, rather than segregating him off and saying, oh, no Jews ever of that time had any of the ideas he had, as if he dropped down from a planet or something. No, he grew up as a Jew in his own time. He probably pored over these very texts and thought, is that me? Is this what I have ahead of me? Now, most scholars would say, oh, no, that was all written later. I'm one of the few scholars that argue that Jesus might have found his own destiny and fate in these texts and then went about trying to do God's will as he saw it instead of being written later. And why would I say that? Because we have an example in the Dead Sea Scrolls where the teacher before his death is already saying, I'm going to be wounded. I'm going to be persecuted. I'm going to be dead. I'm going to be gone. Don't get scattered. Stay strong. Keep the faith.
Amazing. That's super interesting.
I think of the famous Rabbi Akiba of the early second century, one of the great contributors of the Mishnah. He had a great following like Jesus. He had male and female followers. He was great. Nobody made up a resurrection narrative about him. They didn't need to. And so if you and I, Cameron, were trying to invent a false narrative, not a true one, but one that we thought, would take hold, we would never make up. We wouldn't have any psychological motivation to say, hey, Jesus died and he rose again from the grave. We could honor him as a great teacher because of the coherence of Judaism, believing that in a general eschatological resurrection, we could even see that Jesus would rise from the dead someday with all Israel. We wouldn't need to. There's no psychological motivation to make up a resurrection narrative because of the coherence of our religion, unless it actually happened.
Well, I think, look, I don't know whether Bar Kokhba or any of the other dozen or so messianic figures that Josephus mentions in passing are Jewish historian of the period, whether any of their followers held on to their faith in some way even after they had been killed or defeated, because universally the same thing happens to them that happened to Jesus. They get beheaded or crucified almost invariably. Maybe occasionally stabbed with a sword, but they all get killed. That's what happens to messiahs during this period, during the period of Roman occupation, of all stripes and descriptions. And that's what happens to the teacher in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But we have a case in the Dead Sea Scrolls that makes us wonder whether Dr. Johnson's generalization is the case, and that is what the teacher himself says about his life, his thoughts, the persecution that he faces in a document from Cave 1. It's called the Thanksgiving Hymns in English, the Hodayot. And in the hymns 10 through 17, many, many scholars have now agreed that the teacher himself might have authored these hymns. And when you read them, it's chilling because he applies Isaiah 53 to himself, the suffering servant. He talks about being rejected, being persecuted. There's a wicked priest who comes and puts him on trial. Does that sound familiar? A Jewish rival who puts him on trial. And then the possibility is found in a fragment from Cave 4. It's 4Q491 that we now put with the Thanksgiving hymns. Martin Abegg has a major article, and Dr. Johnson will know Martin Abegg very well. He's a major Dead Sea Scroll scholar, in which he argues that 4Q491 is the teacher saying, I am exalted to heaven. I have become like a god. I'm sitting at the right hand of God. Now, the idea of appearances, which I think is the main part of the book, from what I can gather from this short interview, I haven't read the book yet, that would be the gospel appearances of a resuscitated corpse, at least in Luke and John, where he says, oh, I'm not a ghost. Here, give me some food. I'm flesh and bones or so forth. You know, I'm here. But that's not the earliest view. In fact, Paul says, when he describes the resurrection of Jesus, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, that you have to get metamorphosized into one of these life-giving spirits. I think you can make a really strong case that the earliest view of resurrection, not just of Paul, but of all the disciples, was of heavenly glorification. And the problem with that is critics of Christianity came along and said, well, you might have just seen a ghost, or maybe you're hallucinating, or maybe you're mentally ill, or you're schizophrenic. And so they're gradually developed this idea of, oh, no, there were appearances. And notice how it unravels as you go along. Mark has none. Mm-hmm. Matthew has one on a mountain, and some doubted. That kind of sounds kind of hazy, like we're not so sure. Nobody's touching him or saying, oh, it's him. Let's have a meal together. So that's the second account. third account is Luke, and he contradicts and says, don't leave Jerusalem. Jesus in Luke X says, you can't leave Jerusalem. That seems to me a very clear polemic about don't believe all those Galilee stories where they saw a vision like Mark 9, where they see Jesus transfigured in glory. That's Mark's view of resurrection. Don't believe all that. Stay here. And the guy will come and show you he's flesh and blood, and he'll eat with you, and then you'll know it's really real. I think it was an apologetic move by the author of Luke X, very essential for him, because critics in the second century were beginning to say, this really is not very impressive testimony. You got a bunch of people saying they saw and heard something, but should we really order our lives by the visionary experience of people? Today, people claim to see the Virgin Mary. Thousands of people at once. Individuals claim to have Jesus appear in their room and speak to them. I have no doubt of their sincerity and their devotion, but it's really hard to think, well, you could prove any of this because it's all taking place in terms of this visionary experience that people maybe see a light or hear a voice, and some see it and some don't, if they have faith and so forth. So we call this apparitions. It's known throughout the history of religions. In every religious tradition, you have these kinds of things. And from a scientific or historical view, they go outside the realm of history. All I can say, if I have a good source, is someone reported this. Well, with the four Gospels, you can't even say someone reported it because we don't know who wrote those things. And we think they're later. You know, the only first-person account of resurrection, and that's the only one I would give any credence to, is Paul. But what does he say? Last of all, he appeared to me. I had an apparition. Say, well, he doesn't say apparition. That's what apparition means. I had an appearance. I saw the Lord. But then when he's asked, well, what kind of a body? I couldn't describe it, but it's glorious and powerful and immortal, and it's not flesh and blood. So the earliest testimony to the resurrection of Jesus is first person by Paul, but it's of his visionary experience. Now, that could be enough for someone. Say, well, I don't think Paul was deluded, and I don't think he lied, so I'm going to believe it. But Paul doesn't say anything even similar to what we find in Luke and John with this eating of meals and so forth. And that's a typical motif in the Hellenistic world to try to show that it's not a ghost. Give the ghost some food, and if the food disappears, then you know it's not a ghost. Kind of like Santa Claus coming. And I'm not trying to trivialize it here, but how do you fool the kids? Daddy takes a bite out of the cookie, right? And Daddy says, yes, son, he's really real. Look, there's a bite out of the cookie gone. Now, that's harmless fun on Christmas morning. But when it comes to people changing their whole life and worshiping somebody as the creator of the universe, a preexistence, the whole package that goes with Christianity and forming a religion around it, I don't think the early followers had that idea. They thought the end was coming very near. They did believe that Jesus had been exalted to heaven, and some were seeing visions of that glorified Jesus, apparently, and Paul talked to them. But I do not imagine when Paul met Peter that they sat down and Peter said, oh yeah, I remember the time Thomas touched him and he ate some fish with us. I think that's how Dr. Johnson and others are imagining this.
Yeah,
I imagine it was something like Peter said, well, what did you see? And Paul would have described what he saw. Well, maybe it was the Acts account. You know, I was on the road. We don't know for sure, you know, exactly what he saw, but probably a voice, because he talks about hearing voices from Jesus, maybe a blinding light, which is what you get in the book of Acts, maybe something like that. But what he does say about his ascent to heaven, he says, I can't tell you whether it was in the body, out of the body, and I can't even describe to you what I saw because it's unutterable. Now, that can mean I'm not allowed to utter it, which I think it does partly mean because he said it's not lawful to utter. But it can also mean what he says in 1 Corinthians, I can't describe Jesus resurrected to you. How could I do that? It was glorious and beyond anything in this world. And someday you who believe will also have that glory. So I think the Gospels should be put chronologically in their place, and they're part of an apologetic development. And Dr. Johnson's book is continuing that apologetic development to try to say, no, this really happened. And it essentially implies something that I think should be very disturbing to religious people, that if somebody claims a vision, not a physical appearance in their bedroom or something, you know, no, it was real. Grandma came, she was sitting in a chair. We drank a cup of tea together. I took a picture of the empty teacup. But somebody says, no, I feel Jesus is leading me or talking to me. It kind of puts that down and says, well, we don't know about that. That could be a hallucination. But there are millions of Christians who run their lives by the feeling and the belief that Jesus is telling them things, guiding them. I grew up in it. All of my friends that I knew growing up in evangelical Christianity would say they've talked to Jesus, they've met Jesus. They would, some of them would even say they saw him in some fashion. Everything from a dream to a vision when they were praying or something, that presence came into their room and they could feel it and so forth. So there's a sense in which the Gospels are playing down that and saying, no, we need a body. We need a resuscitated corpse, or the creator of the world somehow could not have exalted Jesus. I don't think the early Christians were interested in bones or corpses. I think they were interested in their faith that although he died and really died, he's dead, that he has been exalted to heaven in a new body.
So that's the quickie treatment on it. I think that's a really exciting, what psychological motivation is there if you're a Jew, which all the first Christians were Jews, to make up this narrative if you didn't need it? And we see other examples of that. After all, Cameron, there are 28 different Jewish men who have claimed to be the Messiah, 28 different messianic contenders. I get into some of the messianic contenders or pretenders in Body of Proof as well, where I talk about some of the features. We even hear about some of these in the historical documents that make up the New Testament, Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel, who brings up two of them when he makes that interesting statement about the early nascent Christian movement, that if this is of man, it'll fail like the others, like that guy who took the Egyptians, the 4,000 Egyptians out into the wilderness, or he names these different messianic movements. But he said, if it's of God, we'll be fighting against God. We won't be able to stop it. And so leaning into this, I would love to see some students take up this call and say, what psychological motivation exists to invent a resurrection narrative? Because they sure didn't for Rabbi Akiba. Why make it up for Jesus?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think it's very simply answered. When the charismatic messianic leader of a movement is killed or murdered or dies at the hands of an enemy, as we have in these cases, there is a tremendous psychological drive to believe that though he died, somehow his cause lives and goes on. And since you're dealing with the heavenly world, according to Paul, not this earthly world, right? Mm-hmm. A spiritual body, he calls Jesus a life-giving spirit. Says the first man, Adam, was of the dust. The new Adam that he thinks Jesus was and is of the spirit. If we've borne the image of the dust, we shall bear the image of the spirit. And he's talking about the resurrection of the dead. That's the topic, okay? So what's the psychological motive? Notice he uses this term, make up, to belittle the sincere faith of people whose leader dies and they just make something up, mm-hmm. as if their motives are bad. When people lose a loved one, when a movement loses a beloved leader, the most common thing that happens, not that they just make something up in some fraudulent way, but they come to believe that though he dies, yet he lives, or something along those lines. In other words, it's somehow the person survives. I think it's very ill-advised to treat spiritual experiences that people claim all throughout the ages for all kinds of faith and hope that they have as making up things and wondering what the motive would be, as if it would be an evil motive. I studied David Koresh and the Waco group extensively, okay? I wrote a book on it. I was involved with it. I helped the FBI. My materials with Dr. Phil Arnold went into David Koresh, our messages. Now, I know some of his followers to this day, and it's been 30 years, right? And they believe that he's in heaven and he'll return again, and he's been raised to glory. Now, you say, oh, David Koresh, that child-molesting polygamist, who cares about what he says? Well, if you've ever met the people or even listened to many of David's teachings, you'll see that there's a level of sincerity in all messianic religious groups. And I think it's horrible the way it ended. But I wouldn't go up to a Branch Davidian and say, well, what possible psychological motive would you have for feeling that David Koresh has appeared to you or spoken to you? Because they have told me that they feel his presence and they feel his spirit. And do I believe that? No, I think he's dead. What I believe about Jesus, I'll tell you what I believe about Jesus. And I say this in my classes. It sounds like some atheistic, awful type statement. First of all, I'm not an atheist. But secondly, I don't take labels like that. I think the cosmos is much more complicated than anybody's label. I think he's a human being, born of a man and a woman, and he's dead. Now, is that all I have to say about him? Absolutely not. I've spent 45 years studying him because I think he's a remarkable human being. I think he lived in his own time, and I want to understand him, and he's the most influential person in human history. Now, maybe Dr. Johnson would say, oh, so he's just a good teacher, as if being a human being who lives and dies and has a normal birth and a normal death diminishes you somehow. You've got to be this pattern of heavenly exaltation to have significance in your life. I'm very drawn to the historical figure of Jesus, as are many of my colleagues, Jewish and Christian background, who would say he's not alive today. He died like any human being. But that's blasphemous. You can't say that. You're suddenly on the side of evil if you even say something like that. I mean, what are the two most ordinary things about you, Paul? You were born and you're going to die.
Exactly.
And there are no exceptions. And that's life and that's reality. And what is beyond is a mystery to all of us. It could be everything. It could be nothing. But in terms of this idea that if anybody believes somebody has appeared or somehow survived death, that they have a bad psychological motive. And maybe he didn't mean it quite like that, but it came across like that to me. It seems to be an apologetic point that's being made, but I don't think it's very humane in the sense of really being sensitive to the sincere beliefs and hopes of people who've had leaders that they've lost and believe that somehow their cause still lives on beyond death.
Well said. Well said. So I think that's a great place to leave it. As you mentioned, it so happens that your course covers a lot of these topics in more detail. Why should people sign up for Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls?
This course I have on the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's shaped and formed by me teaching the Dead Sea Scrolls for the past 30 years at three major universities, traveling to the Holy Land over 75 times over the years, doing archaeology, history, and so forth. So I try to bring all of that to the course. And to ask the question, if we look at Jesus, and that's my field of study, the historical Jesus, and the teacher in the Dead Sea Scrolls, their teacher and their movement and their beliefs, and the Dead Sea Scroll movement is over 100 years before Jesus, probably about 150 years, and we compare them, where do we come out? And there are some amazing similarities and some amazing differences. But there are enough parallels to be able to say that most of the things I cover in the course, you could never say about a Pharisee or a Sadducee, but you could say about the Essenes, if that's the name for them, and we have a whole lecture on that, or let's just call them the community who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, this believing community, because they're a messianic, apocalyptic, new covenant group. So the reason the course, I think, could be very useful for lots of people, it's college level in the sense that the information I'm bringing is based upon my years of teaching, but I break it down into 10 episodes or lectures with a guidebook, with all kinds of texts and extra readings and videos and helps. And then I meet monthly with the students at the end of each month. And I'll probably do that for the next 5 or 6 months. The course just came out. We were having our first meeting soon. But students will be part of that too. And that's not a webinar where I get up and talk and you just sign in and watch a guy talk for an hour and a half. No, that's a Zoom gathering. We get together around the Zoom room and we get to ask questions and interact. And it's an amazing phenomena that takes place because these students have studied the actual Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, how many people say, oh, I'm so interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but like, what translation would I buy and how would I begin? And do I just start reading them or what's the background? What's the history? You get all of that in the course and all of the controversies and some of the new scrolls, like the one we just discussed, 4Q285. That was a newly published scroll in 1991. And we cover these new scrolls that are giving us additional insights that many people have not kept up with or even heard. It's just a tremendous course. I love it. I'm bragging on my own course because I've taught it for years. And I see how students are so changed and engaged by taking this course. And they really have something then to talk about and discuss as they study maybe Christianity or ancient Judaism or just the history of ideas in general from the ancient world. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're our oldest documents from the ancient world that we have in actual physical copies that have to do with the apocalyptic messianic movements of ancient Judaism. So I hope people sign up, and if they do, I'll get to see you later. And we record those Zoom meetings too, so even if you can't make a meeting, you get everything as part of the course for life. You own the course.
Excellent. Well, if you want to join us for Dr. Tabor's in-depth College Level Without College course, head over to tinyurl.com/TaborDSS. That's TaborDSS. Or find the link in the description, and you'll not only be investing in your own education, but you'll also be helping the mission of this channel. Speaking of which, thank you so much to each and every one of my members and patrons, without whom these videos wouldn't be possible. If you're willing and able to join them, please find the link in the description. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Tabor. A pleasure, as always.
Good to be with you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
To see my previous analysis of Dr. Johnson with Dr. Kip Davis, tap on the link on screen now, and I'll see you over there. Until next time, later.